I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. President Obama sketched this week a three-year annex on George Bush's war in Iraq. No ground troops, no invasion, no occupation, and still a promise of victory, the president said, over the chaos and terror of the Islamic State, as it's called. Next week, there's a White House summit on confronting violent extremism at home and abroad, as if to suggest we're still figuring out what to call it, where it comes from, how to beat it. This hour, our own radio summit with full-time watchers and warriors who will not be at the White House but might have been. First, the Dutch-Indian-English author Arun Kundnani, who teaches media at New York University and terror studies at John Jay College in New York. The New York Times columnist at large in the world, Roger Cohen, is with me in our Boston studio at WBUR. We will all be listening to what a released Gitmo prisoner and acclaimed author Muazzam Begg told us that he would say to President Obama when we spoke on the phone from London this week. And then Karima Benoun, burned by terror growing up in Algeria. She's now a law professor in California, and she's going to tell us about the trials of the middle way that we're missing in the Middle East. First, on Boston Common this week, we asked people what they would say to President Obama about breaking a cycle of outrage and injury.
Gosh, it's the hardest question ever. There's no overnight solution. Just talk. Sit down at a big table and take as long as it is to make them realize that their purpose or their beliefs are misguided, destructive, evil in some cases, on both sides.
You know, I mean, in an ideal world, you walk away and let people finally have their tribal war and we stay out of it, but that's not what's going to happen, you know. Too much financial interests.
It's just like a real awful media narrative. Like, I don't know. I feel like people are just always assume like, oh, they're the bad guys, and just not having the right conversation to begin with.
Until the whole world gets on the same page, which I don't think we ever can be. We have different religions, different belief systems, different lifestyles, different governments.
Well, I don't know. Right now, we're the enemy over there, you know, from most of the Muslim world. That's for sure. You know, and who is that general that said, our God's stronger than your God? That's like, give me a break here, will you?
So I think starting with school, because I'm a teacher, that they need to tell the truth about history. There's a lot of lies about who we are, what we've done, versus what other countries have done.
The airstrikes from the West, ultimately, they'll have a short-term impact, make some difference, but no, they're not the answer, in my opinion. Airstrikes, violence of any kind is so rarely the answer.
Arun Kundnani, lead us off from New York. Place yourself at the White House. Suppose President Obama notices your lineage, your travels, your study of terror and fear, and this 35-year war, say, since the Mujahideen and the CIA war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Like the rest of us, the president wants to hear the world's narrative here. How would you describe it?
The first thing I'd say to the president would be that we've kind of, over the last 20 years especially, come up with this account of what this conflict is about that is fundamentally misguided. So the story we've told ourselves over the last 20 years is that there is a religious ideology out there, an extremist ideology that somehow has the power to turn Muslims into violent fanatics, and that is the root cause of the problem. And so then the solution is to go after that ideology in various ways, whether that's in military means or whether that's through other initiatives to combat that ideology. And that's why, you know, a number of the voices we just heard were talking about the problem in terms of religious belief, some notion that this is about different ideas of God and so forth. The truth is that what this conflict is really about is it's not driven by a religious ideology so much as a very simple narrative that says the West is at war with Islam. And that's the message that is being used to recruit people to participate in organizations like ISIS. It's not you know, in-depth theological arguments from the Quran or the classical Islamic sources. It's a simple message that we are Muslims and we're being subjected to a war from the West, and therefore we need to fight back against that.
And the president, the president obviously says, well, I'm not at war with Islam, and not even George Bush was at war with Islam. What are you talking about?
Well, the problem is that, you know, that's the, that to some extent is the rhetoric that has come out of the White House, but the perception is very different, and almost all of the actions that we have taken since 9/11, if not earlier, have reinforced the narrative that groups like ISIS are using. They've reinforced the idea that the West is at war with Islam by, you know, the largest example of this is the war in Iraq, which, you know, had no connection to 9/11, but was a majority Muslim country. And the fact that we, you know, especially under Obama, have a drone strike program that targets Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan. These kinds of forms of violence are only being used on Muslim majority countries. Now, that's not because Obama hates Muslims. It's to do with the kind of global geopolitics here. But certainly, it reinforces the narrative that what this is about is a war between the West and Islam, and that's entirely counterproductive. And that's why we're still, you know, we're still in this conflict after so many years.
I take your point that Al-Qaeda has trapped us into sort of demonstrating its main point for them. But on the other hand, how do you weigh a judgment like that, that it's the West against, or that some deeply or consciously it's our war against them? How do you judge that? Particularly, I mean, they did strike New York on 9/11. They do grotesquely awful, inflammatory things. How does one weigh, balance the scales here, or see them in proportion, really?
Right. I mean, you know, 9/11 was the worst single day of non-state terrorism in the modern era. That can't be downplayed in any way. And that's an event that is always going to resonate here. But then, standing in Iraq, things are going to look very different. Where hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of civilians have been killed as a result of our actions. Standing in Pakistan, things are going to look very different. With thousands of people killed there by drone strikes and our support for the Pakistani military, which is a hugely oppressive influence in that society. Time and again, we support in the Middle East the worst possible allies, the most authoritarian regimes. And really, until we stop doing that, we're just going to continue to reinforce this compelling narrative that drives terrorism, and we're blocking the kind of genuine alternatives that might emerge in the Middle East or in a country like Pakistan.
Arun Kundani, what does religion have to do with it?
Well, I think the role of religion here has been hugely exaggerated. I think what religion does in these movements like ISIS and Al-Qaeda is provide a kind of cohering identity, but it's not religion that's driving the violence as such. It's becoming increasingly clear that when you look at the young people who are traveling, say, from Europe to join ISIS, they've got very little familiarity with any kind of religious traditions. They are, there was a story the other day of a couple of recruits who turned up in Syria with the Beginner's Guide to Islam, but the most basic introductory text to learning about the religion, and had no familiarity at all. And that's entirely consistent now with everything we know about how this recruitment works. It's convenient for us to think that it's this alien religion that somehow is bound up with everything that's happening, but it's actually as much about our own foreign policy. What's recruiting people is images of violence, whether that's the images of civilians being killed in Iraq, whether that's the photographs from Abu Ghraib, whether that's now in Syria, the kind of videos that circulate online of very violent incidents. It's kind of almost like a pornography of violence. It's that really is the imagery that's being used to recruit people. And so the great danger that we keep falling into this mistake of trying to think about this through a religious lens, when really it's a political problem and a problem of a kind of militarized identity politics.
There's a problem with cycles here too, and it's getting to be a very, very long pattern now. 14 years into a war with Al-Qaeda, which we'd never heard of before. But it's not just a cycle of killing, it's a cycle of affirmation, confirmation of they're bad guys, look at what they're doing. And it goes back and forth, round and around, apparently without an end. How do we deal with this?
You know, I think we need to go back to kind of first principles about notions of justice and violence and the legitimacy of different kinds of violence, right? So if we're in a war on terror, what is terror? Terror is the use of violence against civilians to achieve political ends. And so to the extent that we kill civilians, we're part of the problem. And I think, you know, we absolutely need to condemn the violence of groups like ISIS. But if we're going to do that without hypocrisy, then we also need to condemn our own actions when they result in the deaths of civilians, as they do in very large numbers. And so I think kind of doing something more consistent in terms of our moral position here would add hugely to our credibility as a force for peace and democracy and human rights in the world.
First we have to see it, though. That's the puzzle to me. So much of this happens out of sight, out of mind. I should have said, Arun Kundani's new book is called The Muslims Are Coming: Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Coming up, the New York Times columnist at 30,000 feet, Roger Cohen, at home in the world. South Africa born, with Lithuanian Jewish roots, schooled in England, an American citizen as of a few months ago. His new book is about the threads of oppression, privilege, place, displacement, loss, memory, and identity through it all. We'll be right back. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, getting our bearings in the war on terror. President Obama proposed a 3-year extension this week and some legislative tweaks on the authorization of George Bush's war 12 and a half years ago, right after the 9/11 attacks. But in case you're wondering, the war is still on. Roger Cohen, give us your long view of this long war, as we used to call it, a war on Islam, a war in Islam, a war from Islam?
Well, Chris, it certainly looks like a war on Islam for many people around the world. If we've been at war in Iraq and we've been at war in Afghanistan, and plenty of people in the Congress now are talking about going to war in Iran, that would be three countries across a front of many thousand miles. And then we turn around and say, we have no problem with Islam. We're not at war with Islam. It certainly looks that way. Nevertheless, I think we need to recall that 9/11 happened before the war in Iraq. And there's been for a long time in the Muslim world a feeling of having been abused by Western colonialism, of the U.S. having a one-sided view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, always coming down on the side of Israel. And these resentments have been boiling up, and an ideology has emerged that gives that a framework, and for young people, often marginalized, can be very appealing.
I got to mention, you tweeted after the Charlie Hebdo attack that it was outrageous. You were quivering with anger, and it demanded a ruthless response from the free world. What did you mean? And do you still mean it?
It was in the moment, and I was full of fury. I'm a journalist. I've sat many times around a table thinking about what goes in the next day's paper. And for these representatives of violent extremist Islam to march in and say, you have no right to do that, we're going to gun you all down, I just felt we cannot tolerate this. We have to respond. And I felt that the response to ISIS has been of a of a pinprick kind, these airstrikes that have not been very effective. And we need to muster. Ruthless doesn't just mean military force. It means mustering all the forces we can find of persuasion, of coercion, and other means to try and reverse the tide. This ideology, and I think, unlike Iran, that there is an ideology there. It's been metastasizing, but the core of it is there. It's there in the notion of restoring a caliphate, of imposing Sharia law. It's a perversion of Islam, but that's where it draws its roots.
You know, for me, I think habitually I don't believe in defining wars as religious. Maybe that's the Irish in me. I could never imagine Northern Ireland and the Republic being fighting over theology or God or anything. It was all class, history, imperialism, etc. But taking it in a different direction, though. It's the pragmatist in me that is troubled by the history of this war. How do we come to grips with the unmistakable record that our military response to every outrage has made the disaster infinitely worse? Osama bin Laden died happy. He had driven us crazy.
Yeah, there was a huge disorientation, and it lasted at least a decade after 9/11. The United States' self-image did not include attacks that killed 3,000 people in New York and Washington, D.C. I think if we'd gone to war in Afghanistan, which is where the attack of 9/11 stemmed from, and we'd eliminated al-Qaeda, and we had not been distracted into what proved to be a disastrous war in Iraq, then the history might have been different. Mm. We might have dealt with al-Qaeda. Now, at this point, again, the ideology keeps finding new recruits. In Europe, there are a lot of alienated Muslims, marginalized, and they're being drawn by the sense of mission that this ideology gives them. It's going to be long. It's going to be very difficult. And I think that we mustn't forget that part of the anger against the United States, Chris, comes from the failures within Arab society. We are 3 years from the Arab Spring. There was a moment there where it looked like all the forces in society might be able to express themselves. Except, instead, we have the same polarization between political Islam and authoritarianism. People are frustrated, and they look at the United States. It's an easy focus.
You, like me, were caught up very much in the Arab Spring enthusiasm. But speaking of alienated Muslims in Europe, and under the heading of seeing ourselves as Americans as others see us, we had a bracing conversation this week with Muazzam Beg. He is an English-born man of Pakistani Muslim ancestry. He was scooped up by American and British intelligence in Afghanistan 4 months after 9/11. He was offloaded to Egypt for torture alongside another suspect who was waterboarded and electric shocked until he made up some of the evidence that persuaded Colin Powell to sell a fake case for war to the United Nations. So every link that Muazzam Beg recounts in his book, Enemy Combatant, is a link in his argument that a spy war dragnet went direct to torture, then to false confessions, to phony justifications of a wrong-headed war, and then to uncounted death in the wasteland of Iraq. And now and then we get violent blowback with Arab Muslim signatures on it. Here is part of my conversation with Muazzam Beg.
The war in Iraq produced al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq didn't exist up until the war on the invasion. What you got then after al-Qaeda in Iraq then became, eventually after Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, we went there, the Islamic State in Iraq. And then when the war in Syria began, it became the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham or the Levant. And now it's become Islamic State. So you can see the trajectory directly, a direct causal link that led to the creation of ISIS. It's important also to note that the 17 of ISIS's 25 leadership members were held in the camps of US and British detention sites like Camp Booker in Iraq, and they were dressed in orange suits. So now when they dress people in orange suits and execute them, you can see that it's almost like a reaping a whirlwind. This is what was done to them. As anybody would know who studied abuse, is that once somebody's been abused, they become often the abuser.
This story keeps unfolding. Two things I'd love you to comment on. One, President Obama's commitment to a 3-year war with ISIS, but also a summit at the White House in the next few days talking about remedies, ways to confront violent extremism. Imagine you were called as a witness and they said, Mr. Begg, you've had hard experience over 13 years. What have you learned about violent extremism? What would you tell them?
I think, like with any victim of abuse, there is a great danger in the abused becoming an abuser. And one of the things I would cite and quote is that the leadership, including Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is the, you know, the self-declared caliph of ISIS, have all been inmates of Camp Booker. They have been subjected to, and I would say that they have been radicalized into behaving, not completely, but into behaving the way that they are. And part of that behavior is this complete rejection, this complete vitriol and hatred of anything that seems Western, because you have to remember, these guys have never been to America, but America has been to them. And it has shown them a side of it that America would never, even to this day, I think even after 100 years have passed, will still never see the truth. But the Iraqis know the truth. They know, they've seen their relatives, they've been in those prisons, they've been in Abu Ghraib, they've been strip searched, they've been raped, they've been tortured, they've seen the mass rapes that were carried out against the women. They know, after Obama said in 2010 that we cannot allow the publications of certain photographs that showed clearly the terrible abuse of young children, for example, being raped in front of their mothers, or women being gang raped, he said that this will cause damage to our troops on the ground. Well, the damage was already done when the troops did those actions in the name of the United States of America. And they will never forget that. It's now in the Iraqis' collective memory. You don't have to have photographs for people to tell their relatives that this is what happened to them. So America has to bear some responsibility and recognize and not hide behind the fact that these things have happened and Americans have committed this. The only way to reconcile with all of this, to prevent violent extremism, isn't more violence. Violence isn't the answer to violence. If you want to take an example from South Africa, is that they had a truth and reconciliation process. That means people have to come clean with what they've done. That means the people who want to see themselves as the good guys, even if that means that they look like the bad guys, have to be clean about what they've done. And once you start doing that, then your enemy, whoever they are, starts recognizing and seeing your humanity rather than seeing your inhumanity, which is what they have thus far witnessed.
I hate to confess it, but most Americans have no idea of the stories you're telling, partly because they don't want to know and the media doesn't present it very sharply. But they have basic questions. What does Islam have to do with all of this?
Well, in the great scheme of things, I would say not a lot. This isn't necessarily about Islam. This is necessarily about what's being done to people who happen to be Muslim. We could go back and look, for example, in the 60s and the 70s and what happened in Vietnam and see, is it 1 million or 2 million people who got killed during that war?
Maybe three.
That had nothing to do with religion at all. It had to do with a perception of an ideology, but really in the great scheme of things, it meant nothing. And I would say here, in the great scheme of things, this isn't about that. Now, there are people who want to make this into a war between Islam and the West, but it's much more complicated than that. It's about resource. It's about possession. It's about a fear of the rise of another bloc that may become unified on an Islamic principle. But this isn't about killing people based upon their religion. And it shouldn't be that. That's what it shouldn't be. Islam means submission. It also means peace. It also means a way of life and a system of life. People have lived it for the past 1,400 years. There have been conflicts between the Muslim world and the rest of the world, but also there have been conflicts within the Muslim world in itself.
And what does the jihadist fighting faith of Islam have to do with the motivation on their side?
Well, I think, again, this is something that if you watch, and I'm not a great fan of bad movies, but if you watch Rambo 3, starring Sylvester Stallone, the entire film is dedicated to the Mujahideen, and those are the people who wage jihad, of Afghanistan. Now, it's important that we remember that when the West wants to, it gets amnesia. And it forgets that it has and probably will in the future support jihad and jihadis and whatever you want to call them when it suits its purpose. So the Americans supplied the Stinger anti-aircraft missile system to the Afghan Mujahideen during the 80s. If you read the Charlie Wilson's War and see the film and the book, you'll see and know that they were shouting Allahu Akbar alongside the Mujahideen, American diplomats were, and lionizing those people who were fighting against the Soviet menace. And it was under the concept of jihad, of Islamic law, the Sharia and Islamic terminology and martyrdom and so forth, that didn't prevent anybody in the United States from saying that these are the good guys. And in fact, Reagan likened the Mujahideen to the founding fathers of the United States of America. So it's very crucial that any audience, American audience or otherwise, is educated and told this isn't about jihad being good or bad. This is about interests and how they change, and language changes according to it.
Mr. Begg, what is the lure of jihad today, or joining ISIS, or getting into the battle in the Middle East for young people in Europe, in the Middle East, even in the States?
Youngsters who really didn't know much about their faith. And one thing is clear, that the majority of the young youth who are going to fight for ISIS really don't know much about their faith or their identity. They're having an identity crisis. They're told continuously in the West that you're part of a religion that doesn't belong. You don't belong. Your ideas don't belong. Your faith doesn't belong. Get out if you don't like it here. And so that's the push factor. The pull factor is that ISIS has said that we are an Islamic state. We are the caliphate. We are the ones that will protect you. You will fit here, and you will also have an adventure. And it's no different in the Muslim world.
Last question, back to the White House. Imagine you go to the summit on confronting violent extremism, and President Obama says, I want to listen to you.
Well, I would say that, look, you need to somehow undo 15 years of warmongering and fighting and killing in the Muslim world. And I don't know how you're going to do that, but you cannot find a solution from a policy that has already failed. And that is through more bombing, through more attacks, through more saber rattling and more militarism in that region. It simply won't work. To get, for example, these nations who have joined, for example, the coalition against ISIS, has only created more hatred there, because these people there who are disgruntled have always said that these regimes, and if you look at the Gulf regimes, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, and so forth, none of them are democracies. None of them represent their people. So when you get the coalition of dictatorships on your side, it's not fooling anybody. There's no consensus here.
Is it turnable?
It is, but it requires a great deal of hard work. And I know the places where it can be done. It can be done in the places where people don't like it to be done. For example, a U.S. soldier talking to and becoming friends with a Guantanamo prisoner is a crime. It's called fraternization with the enemy. But yet we developed those friendships and relationships. America's not ready for this, of course. But if America allowed former Guantanamo prisoners to come to America, to talk to American people, to give examples and explanations of our experiences, but also to see our humanity, I don't think America's ready for it.
There's a lot more of that Muazzam Begg, whose book is Enemy Combatant, in a podcast on our site, radioopensource.org. Roger Cohen of the New York Times, I keep wondering, in your travels everywhere, do you meet that sort of shock and disbelief at what America's performance has been in the last decade or so? Where we're going? Who's in charge? What's the plan?
I do, definitely. There's a sense of this great disorientation in the United States. I was in Gaza in December, and there's a lot of anger at the United States. In Asia, there's a sense of a blundering power that no longer is able to win wars, find its way in the world. And I think after this season of unwon wars, there's a sense of America as often as a hypocritical or ineffective power. All that said, I'm a naturalized American. The draw of America is still there. I think the image can be burnished again. That ceremony where people from all over the world are coming here to become part of something bigger than it's still there. But it's been a rough decade.
That was the most fascinating thing, and it's in our podcast with Muazzam Begg. At the end, he says, I want to like you people. I know it's a wonderful country. There's a deep affection for our founding principles, but even our cosmopolitanism, our multiplicity, our culture in so many ways. But are we ready, as he said at the end, to rethink, to stop the awful things and find ourselves again?
I don't think we are right now. Look at what's just happened is a failure by any estimate. President Obama has been trying since he came into office to get us out of these wars. And what's he doing as he comes toward the final phase of his presidency? He's asking Congress for powers to fight for 3 more years against ISIS, which is the latest manifestation of something that's been around for quite a long time now. That is a failure, and that is more of the same. So even though this summit is being called and there'll be discussion of other ideas, education and so on, I don't feel the United States is ready for a fundamental rethink at this point.
I thought there was a funny failure on his part to say we're extending this war because we have to or for whatever reasons. He made it sound like a legal tweak.
Yeah, it hardly seems to be news. It's hardly news.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like...
We're going to go to Congress.
Okay, we're going
to... He didn't say I'm getting into the shoes of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and we're on for it for a while longer, but that seems to be the effect. Stand by, Roger Cohen. Coming up, an Algerian scholar now teaching law in California who says none of us know enough about the moderates in the middle of this fight. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who's Ghanaian by birth, spoke at the security conference in Munich this week about the insecurity even of the richest and most authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. Their crisis, in general, he said, is that the old is dying and the new cannot be born.
I am convinced that the choice for the Middle East is not between the status quo and the Islamic State. I think it is between a revolution of the jihadi nature or more liberal revolution along the lines of the aspirations expressed during the Arab Spring.
That was Kofi Annan in Munich. We're trying to see this war on terror as the world sees it, maybe even as history will see it. In a long time. Roger Cohen of the New York Times is in our studio. Arun Kundnani in New York. Karima Benoun joins us from California. She's professor of international law at University of California, Davis. Her book, Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, tells the stories of resistance to fundamentalists country by country across the Muslim world. Welcome, Karima Benoun. Your book on every page is reminding us that the overwhelming burden of Al-Qaeda, of Muslim fundamentalism, is on Muslims and surely non-Westerners. I mean, 4, 5, 6 to 1. Can you explain it?
Absolutely, and I would say that my understanding of what is happening is entirely different than much of what has been expressed on the program so far, based on field research among people of Muslim heritage themselves working against fundamentalism and terror. They do not see it primarily as a struggle between the West and Islam. They understand it primarily as a struggle between their own extreme right wing in their own context and pretty much the rest of the political spectrum, but especially the left, which has taken the lead in the struggle in Muslim-majority contexts against Muslim fundamentalist movements. I'm just back from Tunisia, where I attended the memorial for Shukri Belaid, a leading left-wing lawyer, a human rights lawyer, political activist, who was killed exactly 2 years ago by, it looks like, some sort of grouping of Ansar al-Sharia, an extremist group, but some believe also with some support from al-Nahda, the former ruling party after the revolution in Tunisia. So these people understand this as a political struggle amongst people of Muslim heritage themselves, and they need support from progressives in other parts of the world, which they very often don't get. And when I hear things such as the suggestion that there is no such thing as an extremist ideology out there, that this has been made made up. I find that to be so disrespectful to the people on the ground who have put their lives on the line precisely fighting this very ideology. And I think about somebody like Sharifa Kedar, the president of Jazeera Eruna, which is the Algerian Association of Victims of Islamist Terror. And there were perhaps as many as 200,000 victims of Islamist terror in Algeria in the 1990s. And one of the things she told me is, you can't just fight terrorism. You absolutely have to combat fundamentalism, which is the ideology that motivates this terrorism.
What is the direction of things you felt in Tunisia in the last 2 years, in feeling, popular culture, reality?
I mean, things have shifted. There was tremendous optimism when I was there in the spring of 2011, and at the time when Algerians were sort of cautioning based on their own experience that you have to be careful of the rise of extremism in a rapid transition, many Tunisians said, we're nothing like Algeria. And then when I was back in the country in 2013 and people had been through 2 years of sort of the rise of fundamentalism, the fundamentalist attempt to use the new opening, the new political space in Tunisia, and the backlash against women's rights, against free thinkers, against minorities in Tunisia. Many of them were coming to me and saying, oh my goodness, maybe we are like Algeria. Maybe we really need to look from your experience and learn what we can and really stand together against fundamentalism, which is a danger to our society. And I heard that again and again at the conference. I mean, there is some optimism now based on the results of the latest election in which the fundamentalist party and Nahda did not prevail, although some of their prominent members have now gone into government in coalition. But I think there is also a sense that they have to be very vigilant and that they also have to be very concerned about the regional context when you look at neighboring Libya, where we have now possibly even some ISIS-affiliated groups, where there is widespread instability in the country. They are gravely concerned about what the impact will be on their country. But most of all, people told me right now the critical issue is the economy and economic development. And I interviewed a young trade union activist who had been very active in the cyber campaign for the Tunisian Revolution. And he said to me, if he could advise right now policymakers in the West, he would say one of the critical aspects of the struggle against extremism has got to be support for economic development.
Karima, let me ask, what does the West have to do with it, both with confronting the problem, but also what is the West's hand in inflaming this situation? In Libya, for example, but most particularly in Iraq.
I'm happy to talk about that, although I worry that Westerners always want to see themselves as the center of everything, either on the right or on the left, and sometimes there are local dynamics which are indeed beyond us. Unfortunately, we indeed have played a negative role at times, and we have to look at that very, very carefully. We have often, as Muazzam Beg admitted, supported jihadist groups. My view of that is perhaps a bit different than his, as he used to run a jihadist bookstore. He is a sympathizer with jihadist groups. He arranged talks for the jihadist leader Anwar Awlaki to British Muslim youth. That's the side of him that we didn't get to hear about. He might have a different view of that, but it is indeed true that when it has been useful, the United States, with our Saudi and other allies, have supported groups like the Mujahideen, like Hizbi Islami in the Afghan context, one of the worst of those groups. And indeed, the view of many people in North Africa was many people who are working against extremism, the view was that the West, after the revolutions of 2011, really did want to support the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Nahda in Tunisia, and sort of saw them as the force that might keep order the way that the autocrats had in the past. And this was simply sort of a new form of autocracy with which to do that.
Karima, I want to let Arun Kundani push back if he wants to on this matter of religion as a motive, sort of fuel of this whole movement.
Yeah, no. So of course there is an ideology, an extremist ideology, a fundamentalist ideology, political Islam, however you want to label it. And of course, we need to support people who are opposed to that from the left. There's no disagreement there between me and Karima. But I think The point here is whether we want to hitch ourselves to the war on terror in doing that. And the mistake that I think Karima might be making, and others certainly make, is that we think that somehow fundamentalist religion is the root cause of terrorism. when all the evidence tells us that isn't the case. And to think that it is the case is counterproductive from the point of view of peace, and also it actually undermines the local political struggles that precisely Karima is talking about, because it confuses them with the war on terror, which discredits those political struggles coming from the left if they allow themselves to be part of what is effectively a kind of a form of imperialism coming from the US. Those struggles need to be fought independently of the US, which is only going to be a force for undermining those struggles.
Karima, what's your investment in the war on terror?
I just want to say one other thing in response to what Karima had to say, which is, you know, like using words like jihadist in relation to Mozambique is a little bit of a slur. I mean, he's not having an opportunity to defend himself here. The picture of the bookshop and the lecture that you mentioned is a lot more complicated than the kind of simple account that you gave.
Not at all, actually. Anwar al-Awlaki, we know, is the person who inspired the Qureshi brothers who carried out the Charlie Hebdo attack, the person who inspired the underwear bomber. And
indeed, but when he was invited
and his organization
to speak in
actually
Britain,
invited
but when he was invited to speak in
to,
Britain, he'd not yet come
who
to
invited
yet.
To speak to young Muslims. So I'm sorry, I'm very familiar with the situation, and I characterized it exactly accurately. And I'm afraid you've put words in my mouth as well about motivation of terrorism, which I actually hadn't gotten to address yet. But I believe, Chris, you had a question for me.
Yeah. What use would you make of the war on terror from here on out? What is it? Is it helping? Is it not a big part of the problem? Our war on terror?
I believe that it is unfortunately true that at a certain point when there are armed movements that are killing mass numbers of civilians, it becomes necessary to use force to protect the civilians. And I've seen this on the ground in Algeria. I've seen what the consequences were when that action was not taken. But that force absolutely has to be used in accordance with international law and preferably by local forces where that is possible. And I interviewed a leading Algerian expert on terrorism who's based in France just after the Paris attacks, Mohamed Sifawi, and he stressed to me that force and security response can only be what he called the tip of the iceberg. It has to be part of a much broader, complementary, comprehensive response that includes educational aspects, economic aspects, ideological aspects, development aspects, and many others. And the reality is that the use of force is also a dangerous instrument. I personally completely opposed the 2003 war in Iraq, which I saw as having nothing to do with this and being completely illegal. And I do think it's right that many of the negative consequences, certainly not all of them, but many of the negative consequences we're seeing in the Iraqi context at the moment are because of that. So I guess my criticism of the right is the idea that one can just sort of use force willy-nilly with no rules because you claim to be fighting terror. But my criticism of the left is sometimes a failure to recognize that people do have the right to be protected from violence by forcible means if necessary.
Roger Cohen, intervene here for peace.
I agree.
Ruthlessly.
I can't intervene for peace. I agree with Karima that we are dealing with a heinous ideology that draws its roots from Islam. And when you see what ISIS has been doing on the ground, mass slaughter, mass rape, the beheadings of the likes of Jim Foley, and this is flowing back into Europe. We've had the killings in Paris, and before that, somebody who wandered back from that front and shot several Jews in the Jewish Museum in Brussels. So I don't think we can just stand by. It's a question of having the right response and using all means, as Karima just described. There is a tremendous sense of failure, I think. For me, who was in Tahrir Square and in Libya and in Tunisia at the time of the Arab Spring, and when you saw Brotherhood people and westernized Egyptians embracing and saying, we can all be part of one society, and the failure of that, particularly in Egypt, which is 25% of the Arab world, that is a huge, huge failure in which the United States played some part, not the major part, but some. And as long as these societies are locked in this paralyzing conflict where you have dictators on the one side and political Islam becomes the only form of quasi-democratic expression, it's a disaster. In fact, Tunisia, where Karine has just been, is pretty much the only society where there are at least glimmerings of hope for a more representative society, not just representative of one side. In Egypt, now 20% of the population is out of the game. The Brotherhood is out of the game. I mean, that's in the long run, that cannot be healthy, because that's going to fester violence. It's going to fester extremism. It's going to fester everything that comes back to bite the West.
Arun, what is the possibility of just broadening and intensifying, getting real about the conversation, which is so often trumped by this massive military intervention? How do we get talk first?
I think some of the things that we can be thinking about in terms of U.S. foreign policy that get us out of a kind of military approach is a radical reassessment of our alliances in the Middle East, right? I mean, the Saudi relationship is central to so much of this. The Saudis were part of the reason why events in Egypt didn't turn out as well as many of us hoped. And the Saudis are certainly part of the problem in relation to ISIS, at least initially when they first started. Maybe now they're self-financing, but when they first started, they were being funded by the Saudi elites. And so, you know, one of our closest friends in the Middle East is right at the heart of all of these problems, and yet we don't talk about that. Right now the biggest thing we can do is transform our relationship with the Saudis, transform our support for the Egyptian military. Karim is right that it's not all about us, but certainly these aspects of our foreign policy can make a huge difference, I think, in moving the Middle East towards a place where democracy and human rights can become much more likely to emerge.
Karine,
can we weigh in on this? Because this
you may, and I want to hear what you would tell President Obama on the broad question. But
this is a nice occasion for Arun and I to agree, and I agree entirely with him about the importance of changing the policy towards the Gulf. This is something else that Mohammed Sifawi really emphasized to me when I interviewed him, the sort of absurdity of Western governments sitting side by side with the new king of Saudi Arabia and then yet proclaiming to be sort of trying to combat extremism when Saudi Arabia, as we know, has spent, you know, $100 million or more exporting Wahhabism from West Africa to South Asia, something that people complained bitterly to me about from Pakistan to Mali. So I think that's a critical issue. If I could say something to President Obama, I would say that he needs to find ways to empower and to aid and certainly not to undermine the work that is being done by those on the front lines who are combating extremism in a peaceful way through civil society. Those groups do not have access to the funding that they need. They do not get heard here. It's absolutely critical not to frame this as a struggle between the West and Islam, and I think he's been at pains not to frame it that way. But one of the key ways to do that is to really talk about this work that people are doing on the ground. And I think it's
be specific in Egypt, which I know a tiny bit about. Mm-hmm. How and whom would he help in Egypt today?
Well, I don't think focusing on Egypt necessarily helps us to understand the whole what could be done about the whole region now, because there's a very particular dynamic in Egypt at the moment. There, I think it's absolutely critical to pressure the government at the moment with regard to human rights and civil liberties and the kinds of things that are happening, what we've seen with shooting of unarmed protesters recently and so on. But looking across the region, I think it's absolutely critical to highlight the work that people are doing on the ground. And it's not just a question of what the president would do. I mean, here on NPR, we're, you know, talking to progressives, people in civil society here and a broader audience. I think it's also about finding creative ways to reach out and support endeavors like the Network of Women Living Under Muslim Laws that brings women together from all across the affected regions.
Karima, I'm for all of it, but our time is up. I want to give Roger Cohen the very last short word.
I would just add, do not go to war with Iran. If the president can make this deal, can make the nuclear deal with Iran, if Iran begins to come into the world, close to the world, we're never going to be close friends with Iran, but we can have a court. That in itself changes the politics in the Middle East. And remember, Iran is vehemently opposed, a Shiite power opposed to ISIS.
Roger Cohen, I'm glad you get the last word. Thank you, Roger Cohen. Thank you, Arun Kundnani. Thank you, Karima Benoun in California. Our conversation with Roger Cohen about his memoir, The Girl from Human Street, continues online. Look for it next week at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon, with thanks to our wonderful staff and the great Mary McGrath. This is Open Source.